I said, which was pretty charitable. I have my phone, and we're not going to huff rat poison or anything.
Ezra!
She sounded shocked.
Don't be rude. I have every right to worry.
I know, I said in exasperation.
You keep reminding me.
As I pulled out of the driveway, I wondered what everyone from school was doing. I could pretty much guess the crowd that was headed to Jimmy's party to drink a few beers in their bathing suits. And everyone else was probably headed to the Prism Center, this outdoor mall with an IMAX cinema and lots of dramatically lit palm trees. The Prism was really the only place to go in Eastwood besides the Chinese strip mall, and even there, the cops would hassle you to start heading home when it was still early because of the town curfew. I privately thought of them as the Prism Wardens, which was funny for about 2 seconds, and then became infinitely depressing, and not just because the name now reminded me of Cassidy and her Panopticon. It was strange, driving over to Toby's. I'd only ever biked there, on the trails that connect the different subdivisions. Toby lived in Walnut Ranch, one of the older developments south of the Loop. I'd practically lived at his house during elementary school, and as I drove, I remembered flashes of what we'd been like as kids, how we'd taped notes to the undersides of each other's mailboxes, written in a code that only we could decipher. The year we dressed as Batman and Robin for Halloween and then switched costumes just to see how long it would take my dad to notice, the answer being a disturbingly long time. The Cub Scout camping trip, when the scout leader's obnoxious son put a worm in my pudding cup, so Toby and I caught a frog and zipped it inside his sleeping bag, writing swear words in the air with our sparklers on the 4th of July. Begging my mom to take us to Barnes & Noble at midnight to get the latest Harry Potter book, and promising we wouldn't stay up all night reading, but doing it anyway. I'd completely forgotten what Toby had been like back then. How he'd always been the one to devise our elaborate schemes, how he'd constantly gotten me into trouble and then out of it with an aw shucks routine and apology. He'd grown up into exactly the unabashedly nerdy, quick-witted guy you'd expect from a kid who went door-to-door selling homemade comics to raise the startup capital for our summer lemonade stand when we were 10. And I'd grown up into a massive douche with a cane. Toby's house looked the same as I remembered, complete with an unwashed burgundy minivan parked in the driveway. I rang the bell, and a tiny dog started yapping. Toby's sister opened the door. She was wearing a bright pink bathrobe and carrying an angry little terrier that looked like an ankle biter. "Hey, Emily," I said.
"Oh, my God."
She seemed shocked that I'd turned up at her house, as though she'd forgotten I used to know her garage door code. Toby's house was pretty compact, and the front door opened directly into the living room, where three of Emily's friends were watching one of those terrible vampire romance things in their pajamas, sleeping bags already laid out.
"Hi, Ezra,"
one of the girls said, giggling. "Hi," I said. Poor Toby. No wonder he'd wanted me to come over. Thankfully, he came dashing around the corner, fastening a pair of cufflinks.
"Welcome to Purgatory," he said. "Come on in."
Toby's room hadn't changed much. There was a new shelf displaying some action figures I didn't recognize, a police box, and some random dude dressed like Toby in a blazer and bow tie, plus a couple of samurai swords. And then I caught sight of the top shelf of his bookcase and stopped dead.
"You kept them?"
I asked.
"I finished them."
Toby pulled out the thick stack of homemade comics and tossed them onto his bed. I reached for Superhero Academy Volume 1. It was laughingly amateur, done in colored pencil on computer paper, with the byline in alternating blue and red bubble letters, created by Toby Ellicott and Ezra Faulkner. We'd worked on Superhero Academy every day after school in the 5th grade. I think we'd gotten 4 volumes in before suffering from artistic differences, but there were at least 8 volumes scattered across the bed. A few of them were computer-illustrated and almost professional-looking. I picked up Justice University, The Final Battle, and flipped to the end.
Okay, there's no way Invisible Boy could defeat the arch-alchemist with a samurai sword, I argued.
You're just bitter because I made your character evil,
Toby snapped.
Not at all. I just don't get how the arch-alchemist became mortal all of a sudden.
Because he split his soul into 7 pieces and hid them all over Justice City,
Toby retorted.
You turned our comic book into a Harry Potter ripoff?
I spluttered.
Are we seriously having this discussion?
I felt my cheeks heat up, and I tossed the graphic novel back onto the bed with a shrug. Toby sorted them into the right order and returned them to his shelf.
So, are we going or not?
He asked.
Where? Jimmy's party?
I sincerely hoped he wasn't going to annoy me into showing up at that.
I could kill Luke, Toby said. He really didn't invite you?
Invite me to what?
The floating movie theater? You know, that piece of paper with some random words on it and a URL.
Suddenly, I remembered the sheet of paper Luke had passed me in Moreno's class that afternoon. I'd thought it was some stupid flyer for film club. Crap, I said. He gave me something, but I never opened it. I was sort of distracted. Toby snorted.
Yeah, I'll bet you were distracted.
What's that supposed to mean?
Cassidy, dude, I know you're into her, but trust me, it's better to just forget it. She'll get into your head and mess you up.
Believe me, I said with a sigh, staying away from Cassidy won't be a problem. And then I explained how I'd accidentally forced her into joining the debate team.
You are so dead, Toby said.
I didn't realize it was such a big deal, I admitted. You put my name down.
And I figured you'd cross it off.
Toby shrugged.
But Cassidy's different. A forfeit next to her name on the tournament lists would cause gossip. She's the defending champion, you know? Everyone thought she'd rank nationally, but she withdrew from the state tournament 2 days before the primaries, just totally disappeared. To have her name posted as a forfeit from Eastwood, the most pathetic debate team out there? Anyway, are we going to Luke's screening or not? Because we need to pick up coffee filters on the way.
20 minutes later, we were in Toby's spectacularly dinged, hand-me-down burgundy minivan, known fondly as the Fail Whale, trying to coax the broken antenna to pick up an FM frequency as we cruised up Eastwood Boulevard.
Tonight's going to be fun, Toby promised. You'll see.
And I guess it might have been, if I wasn't still lugging around the memory of my earlier douche baggage. Because the more that I thought about Cassidy on the swing set in her bare feet, smiling at me as she promised that we'd escape the Panopticon together, the more I wished I hadn't wrecked everything.
Yeah, fun, I muttered, watching a tumbleweed blow through the crosswalk and latch itself to a yield sign in the center divider.
According to Toby, the floating movie theater was something of a closely guarded legend in nerd circles, and my being invited was a pretty big deal. The history went back to our Cub Scout days, when an enterprising Eastwood High senior named Max Shepard had stolen the janitor's keyring and quietly made himself a copy. He used the keys to play a series of nasty pranks on the administration, successfully evading capture. On his 16th birthday, Luke Shepard inherited the keys to the kingdom from his older brother, but chose to use them for good. And so began the Floating Movie Theater, a series of secret film screenings never held in the same place twice. The campus was pretty deserted, and Toby double-parked his van, straddling the principal's and vice-principal's spots.
"Grab the filters," he told me.
Remind me why I just spent $5 on coffee filters?
Because you have $5 and I don't?
Toby grinned.
No, it's just part of what we do. I mean, we don't want to be caught. We want to be noticed. So we watched Dead Poets Society in Mr. Moreno's room and left behind a ton of whiteboard markers. We watched The Princess Bride in the library and donated a box of books. And tonight, we're screening Rushmore in the teacher's lounge, hence the coffee filters.
Toby stopped walking, waiting for the sheer awesomeness of the floating movie theater to wash over me. Instead, this is what I said. We're breaking into the teacher's lounge?
More like letting ourselves in,
Toby assured me.
Come on.
I planted my feet firmly at the edge of the parking lot.
You better be damn sure we won't get caught,
I warned, because I can't exactly run if the cops show up. Toby started laughing.
Funny story, he said. Max Shepard? Why, just the other week, he let me off on a warning for my busted taillight. Now let's go.
The movie had just started. Toby and I grabbed seats on the side, and I tried to follow along, but mostly what I wound up following was Cassidy's expression.
I suppose she didn't think anyone was looking and had let her guard down, the way you do in an empty room. The way I did when I closed the blinds and stared up at the ceiling fan above my bed, equally fascinated and horrified by the thoughts racing through my brain. She seemed so sad, even though the movie was a comedy and everyone else was laughing, as though she wasn't paying attention to the film at all, but was haunted by images of something else. I'd never seen her like that, and it made me wonder about what Toby had said, how she'd disappeared without warning, and how no one had known what to make of it. A couple of people stood up when the movie ended, but Luke insisted that we had to watch the credits. Surprisingly, they sat back down, looking thoroughly chastised. I hadn't realized Luke carried that sort of power, but it made an odd sort of sense. I'd heard him referred to as the King of the Nerds, and I had never understood why, but I could see it easily then. "So what did you think?" Toby asked as we deposited our coffee filters on a table with everyone else's loot. About the movie? Obviously, the movie is a classic, and Napoleon Dynamite is a pale imitation of this far superior film, Toby said wryly. But no, about this. Secret screenings, coded invitations, positive vandalism. It's awesome, I said. And I meant it. I hadn't known that people did things like this, especially in Eastwood. It was strange, realizing that these sorts of clandestine activities happened at a school I used to think I ran, that there were other things going on besides my old friends' parties. Why don't more people know about it? Because Evan McMillan would turn this into some obnoxious drinking game, Luke said, joining us. Yeah, probably, I admitted, beer funneling through coffee filters. We stood there in silence for a bit, Luke with this knowing look on his face, as though he was glad I'd finally seen what he could do. So, Luke, I said, breaking the silence, how about screening One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest in the nurse's office? I know it'd be a tight fit, but it would be sort of perfect.
Dude, Toby said, that would be epic.
I didn't ask for your ideas, Faulkner, Luke said coldly, drifting over to play host to a nearby group of juniors. He really doesn't like me, I noted.
Nah, of course he does, Toby said unconvincingly. You're pals.
I gave him a look.
His girlfriend used to have the world's biggest crush on you, Toby admitted. Probably still does.
Phoebe?
Oh, Ezra, you're like some sexy vampire, Toby mocked.
I winced, but I had to admit, he had a point.
Hey there, sexy vampire,
someone said, tapping me on the shoulder. Cassidy tucked her hair behind her ears and smiled as though that afternoon, and the past few hours, had never happened.
Hi, I said cautiously.
How much do you love Bill Murray?
She asked, rambling about the movie we just sat through.
I adore him. If he popped the question, I'd Bill Murray him in a second.
I said, confused. Had I missed something? Last time I'd checked, Cassidy hated my guts, and I'd gotten the impression that we weren't speaking to each other any time in the foreseeable future.
Listen, Cassidy said, I could use a protege, so tag, you're it. I'm going to teach you everything I know about debate, and you're going to win first place at the San Diego tournament.
I am?
Yes, and the heavenly cherubs will play tiny ukuleles of joy, and you will lay incense and coniferous fruits at my altar.
Sounds like a plan, I said dryly. Coniferous fruits and goddess worship, check.
That's more like it,
Cassidy grinned.
Oh, look over there, Toby deadpanned, shooting me a sly glance. It's someone I suddenly feel the need to go bother.
I thought you were mad, I said, after Toby left.
Like Hamlet, my madness is fleeting, Cassidy informed me.
No, I thought you were mad at me, I clarified.
Ezra, you're being ridiculous. I'm over it. That's what girls do. They get angry, and then they get over it. Haven't you ever been friends with a girl before?
Of course I hadn't. I dated my fair share of them, but I'd never wanted to be friends with any of the girls in my old crowd. What would have been the point? Maybe Cassidy was right. Maybe it was only girlfriends who stayed mad at you. Still, there was something in her smile that I didn't quite believe, but I accepted my good fortune, knowing better than to question it. 12. Once each September, the teachers had a training day, and we got the day off. Junior year, Evan and Jimmy and I went down to Balboa, ate cheeseburgers on the boardwalk, and watched some terrible 3D movie. But that year, I had totally forgotten about Teacher Development Day until the day before. Unsurprisingly, Toby and the debate crew had a grand adventure planned. They'd purchased tickets to a show in L.A. called Spring Awakening, and Toby was trying, without success, to convince everyone to dress up as turn-of-the-century schoolboys.
"Really, you guys should come with us," Phoebe said, when everyone sheepishly realized that Cassidy and I hadn't been included in the original plan. "We bought our tickets over the summer, but you could still come, even if you got seats in a different section." "That's all right," Cassidy said casually. "Ezra and I already have plans."
This was news to me. Toby gave me a significant look, and I shrugged, having no idea what Cassidy was talking about.
"Yeah? You two going gleaning?"
Sam asked, which made everyone except Cassidy crack up. I should explain. Gleaning is when you pick rotting and bruised crops, the stuff migrant workers leave behind in the fields because it's not good enough to sell as produce. It's actually a required field trip for eighth graders. They bus us over to the old ranch lands for the day, complete with a yearbook photographer, and it's just as terrible as it sounds. Toby quickly filled Cassidy in on what we were laughing about.
"You're not serious," Cassidy said. "Y'all had a field trip to pick rotting tomatoes? What about going to museums?"
"Yeah,"
Toby said dryly.
"Not so much. Welcome to Eastwood."
On the way to third period, I asked Cassidy what she meant about our having plans. She was wearing a white lace dress with straps that wouldn't stay put, and I couldn't help but imagine running my hands over her shoulders, slipping the straps down.
"Oh, that," Cassidy shrugged. "I figure it's the perfect time to start your training. You're going to be my protege, remember?"
"How could I forget?" I teased.
"Good," Cassidy grinned. "Pick me up outside Terrace Bluffs at 8:30 tomorrow morning, and bring a backpack full of school supplies."
Somehow, 8:30 on Wednesday morning felt horrendously early, as though my brain was convinced it should have the opportunity to sleep in on a day off. I yawned my way through a cup of coffee and joined the line of cars waiting to exit the Rosewood gates on their way to work. When I pulled onto the shoulder outside Terrace Bluffs, Cassidy was sitting on the curb, fiddling with a pair of Ray-Bans. She wore jeans and a plaid button-down shirt, a navy blue backpack by her feet. I'd been expecting another of Cassidy's antique clothing concoctions, and this seemed out of character somehow. But even dressed normally, Cassidy was still someone you'd look at twice, without quite knowing why. It was as though she was disguised as an ordinary girl and found the deception tremendously funny.
"I saw a coyote this morning," she announced, climbing into the front seat. "It was in our backyard, obsessing over the koi pond."
Maybe it just wanted a friend.
"Or it was looking for a koi mistress,"
Cassidy observed wryly. It was a reference to a poem, I guessed, but I couldn't place it. I shrugged.
"Had we but world enough and time," Cassidy quoted. "Andrew Marvell?"
Right. It sounded vaguely familiar, like something Moreno had put on an identification quiz back in Honors Brit Lit, but I wasn't exactly a big poetry fan. "So, where are we going?"
"Where we have no business being, other than the business of mischief and deception," she said. "Just drive over to the University Town Center."
So I did, and while I drove, Cassidy told me her theory about winning at debate tournaments. The most successful debaters...
"I'd call them master debaters, but clearly you aren't mature enough to handle that, Mr. Smirky Face," she teased.
"New to reference literature and philosophy and history."
"And the more sophisticated your references are, the better,"
Cassidy said, toying with the air vent.
"You don't want to quote Robert Frost, for God's sake. Quote John Rawls or John Stuart Mill."
I hadn't heard of either of those last two guys, but I didn't say anything. Actually, I was trying to figure out if we were on a date, albeit one that had started at 8:30 in the morning. "We could still go gleaning," I said, nodding out the window as we passed one of the remaining orange groves.
"I don't know why you think that's funny."
"Haven't you heard? It's my hillbilly way of taking you to a museum." Cassidy shook her head, but I could see that she was smiling. The University Town Center was an odd place to be at 8:45 in the morning. I hardly ever went there, since it was a 15-minute drive in the direction of Back Bay, this snotty wasp beach town. Actually, the town's center straddled the border between Eastwood and Back Bay, said border consisting mostly of a Metrolink station,